Across the Pacifica Network and over 50 community stations, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 15, 2003. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Allers. More protests in Iraq as FSRN reports that resistance is coming from many sectors of Iraqi society. Intelligence officials testify that the Bush administration's claims of the existence of mass destruction don't add up. And is America running out of natural gas? Energy experts say yes. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. New numbers on the federal deficit are released today, calling into question the commitment of the president to fully fund essential services. From D.C., Pamela Barnett reports.
The White House Budget Office is forecasting a record $450 billion budget deficit this year, $150 billion higher than its earlier projections, with little hope of a turnaround anytime soon. The White House says the bigger deficits are, quote, manageable, and largely result from military spending in Iraq and Afghanistan. Phil Smith, National Grassroots Director for the Concord Coalition.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out when you have lots and lots of spending and lots of tax cuts, you're going to get lots and lots of deficits, and that's what we're faced with right now.
John Irons of the nonprofit OMB Watch said he believes big deficits are part of the Bush administration's plan to shrink the federal government.
Way back when, we're talking about we could have both a tax cut and, you know, increases in spending thrown in, and it all kind of work out okay. And to a lot of people, that didn't make sense.
This is Pamela Barnett, reporting in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
In a bipartisan show of force, congressional leaders announced today they will attempt to reverse the FCC's June ruling that sets the stage for fewer but larger owners of the nation's media outlets by engaging the Congressional Review Act. Erica Price has more from D.C.
Utilizing the rarely invoked Congressional Review Act, Senators Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, Trent Lott of Mississippi, and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin introduced a resolution of disapproval to effectively veto the recently changed Federal Communication Commission rules. The resolution is sponsored by a bipartisan coalition of 4 Republicans and 5 Democrats and is in response to changes in FCC rules, which decrease limitations on media ownership and allow for greater media consolidation. Senator Dorgan, author of the resolution, believes the changes are a step in the wrong direction.
Many of us are very concerned about concentration in broadcasting and in the media, and the Federal Communications Commission rule moves in exactly the wrong direction, in my judgment.
The senators also announced that they have the 35 signatures necessary to have the resolution considered under expedited Senate procedures. The Congressional Review Act has not been used since 1996. For Free Speech Radio in Washington, D.C., I'm Erica Price.
The head of the Egyptian Intelligence Service arrived in Ramallah today for meetings with Palestinian leaders in order to push forward the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace and to make sure the ceasefire announced by Palestinian factions holds. Mohammed Galghini reports from Gaza City.
One of the main conditions of the ceasefire was the full and unconditional release of Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails. There are approximately 6,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails. 4,500 of them are held without trial, according to Israeli officials, for security reasons. Another 800 prisoners are held in administrative detention, whereas the Israeli authorities can continue to hold them for six-month periods without charge. 350 children under 18 are held in Israeli jails, in addition to 70 female prisoners. According to Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups, the use of torture and brutality against prisoners is widespread. The Public Committee Against Torture in Israel reports that between July 6 and 8, the wardens at the Nevi Terza prison used severe violence against the female prisoners. They sprayed tear gas into small and crowded cells and injured many of the inmates because they didn't answer a roll call. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Mohammed Ghalayini.
Guatemala's highest court has ruled that former military dictator and current legislative president Efrain Rios Montt is eligible to run for president. Catherine Elton reports from Guatemala City.
In a 4-3 vote, Guatemala's constitutional court ordered electoral authorities to accept Rios Montt's candidacy in the upcoming presidential elections. In 2 previous elections, his candidacy was rejected because of a constitutional ban on former dictators running for president. According to legal experts, the court's decision was made on political grounds and threatens the rule of law in Guatemala. Human rights activists charged that the man accused of ordering the genocide of Maya Indians in the 1980s lacks the moral authority to run for president. But according to Rios Montt and his supporters, justice has triumphed, and Guatemalan people can now decide for themselves if they want him for president. Elections will be held on November 9th, and there is now nothing to prevent him from running. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Catherine Elton in Guatemala City.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
George W. Bush says he considers the matter closed, but the administration's erroneous justifications for the Iraq invasion continue to dog him. On Capitol Hill today, veteran intelligence professionals testified that the administration's claims don't add up, and Democrats, too, are now standing up to question the White House in ways they never did before the invasion. Josh Chaffin reports from the Capitol.
Late on Friday, CIA Chief George Tenet took responsibility for the president's now infamous claim that Iraq had tried to get weapons-grade uranium from Niger. But the story isn't going away like the White House might prefer. An internet search this afternoon on Niger, uranium, and Bush brought back more than 1,100 news stories. Democrats in Congress are now feeling ready to stand up to the executive branch.
Who in the administration was pressing the CIA to concur in a statement that the CIA did not believe was true?
A closed-door, Republican-controlled investigation is purportedly underway already. This morning, ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Carl Levin, called for a public investigation, which Republicans are so far resisting.
Why didn't the president say in his State of the Union speech not only that the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa, but that our U.S. intelligence community has serious doubts?
Over on the House side of the Hill, Democratic Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich hosted a pair of veteran intelligence professionals in a press conference where the key word was unbelievable. Unbelievable that the vice president wouldn't have been interested in the result of an investigation into the Niger story that his own office had called for. Unbelievable that the CIA could simultaneously take the blame for the story and then point fingers. And unbelievable that the dubious weapons claims weren't bigger news when the questions surfaced before the war.
The issue now is a little less about Iraq itself and more to do with the whole issue of honesty in government.
Andrew Wilkie resigned from the Australian Office of National Assessments before the war because he said political leaders were purposely misusing his work in order to justify an invasion.
The claim that Iraq was attempting to procure uranium from Niger. The Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, the Australian Department of Defence, and my former employer, the Office of National Assessments, have all conceded that they were in possession of that information before it was used by my Prime Minister.
And before it was used in Bush's State of the Union speech. British officials now say they have more evidence in the uranium from Niger story, but that they can't tell the U.S. where the information comes from, because it comes from a third party, some unnamed other country. Wilkie is not buying it.
I saw day in and day out when I worked in the intelligence community that the third party rule was flaunted when it suited the countries concerned. And to be asked to believe that the US is not aware of that information is just unbelievable.
The Daily Scotsman newspaper reports today, without naming sources, that UK officials will blame the Niger scandal on the French sometime before this Thursday when Tony Blair addresses the US Congress. With all eyes in DC, Canberra, and London focused on yellow cake and aluminum tubes and forged documents, Scott Ritter says he wishes leaders would have heard his message before the war. Ritter is the vocal UN weapons inspector who has long insisted the White House was politicizing the intelligence it received.
We have in our custody every single major scientist and relevant political authority, minus Saddam Hussein and his two sons, that were involved in the past prohibited weapons programs. And all of them say the exact same thing. The programs were dismantled, the weapons were destroyed, nothing remained.
George W. Bush says the U.S. is now working overtime to prove that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the Army's 9,000-person 3rd Infantry Division will remain in Iraq indefinitely. Josh Chaffin in the Capitol for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraq's U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer said today it is, quote, up to the Iraqi people how long U.S.-led forces remain in the country. This as most public services in Iraq are in disrepair and unemployment remains high. The general mood of the Iraqi people is that of frustration and disappointment due to the American administration's slow progress in rebuilding their country's infrastructure, and American allegations that all armed Iraqi resistance is caused by remaining members of the Ba'ath Party and followers of Saddam Hussein are not true. Officer and correspondent in Baghdad, Ahmed al-Arawi, reports resistance also remains high among other segments of Iraqi society.
As the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues through its third month, Iraqi armed resistance activities against U.S. soldiers are increasing. Mohammed Baqir al-Hakim, the famous Shiite leader of the High Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, said in one of his Friday prayers that the popular Iraqi resistance takes three forms: the religious extremists, the nationalists, and the vengeful who were humiliated by the coalition forces.
Man feels a national motivation and a religious one. He is patriotic, so he would like his nation to be free and independent. And because he is religious, he would not like himself to be under any foreign manipulation. It is in this realm that there are spontaneous reactions. I assert here the word spontaneous, for popular communities commit such acts in an unorganized way, since they were subjected to the violent acts by the coalition forces.
According to Al Jazeera Television, two Islamic divisions have claimed responsibility to some of the attacks against American soldiers. One group is called Mujahidu al-Ta'if al-Mansura, or Muslim Fighters of the Victorious Sect, and the other is the Iraqi National Islamic Government, the military divisions of the 1920 revolution. Both groups claim they have nothing to do with Saddam Hussein and both seem to be Islamic-oriented. But according to Dr. Ahmed al-Kubaisi, the famous Sunni leader and head of the Unified National Movement, there is still no organized Islamic resistance in the country. Isra Shakir, the editor-in-chief of the Iraqi Lyom newspaper, explains what al-Kubaisi says.
The resistance against the Americans is not considered a jihad, since there is no imam announcing a jihad. And the other thing he interprets is that any jihad is made by whole communities. What is happening is caused by individual operations.
On the other hand, many Iraqis believe that the present resistance is a popular national outrage against the misdeeds of some American soldiers who represent the occupying power. The Iraqi society is basically based on tribal alliances and customs. Therefore, any humiliation against its tribal members is considered a grave insult. Abdurrahman Al-Isawi is the editor-in-chief of Al-Aswar newspaper, which is published in Fallujah, a city known for its resistance.
The people who resist are popular groups working in an unorganized way. Their acts are personal reactions against criminal and aggravating actions done by American soldiers.
There have been many incidents where American soldiers break into houses in the middle of night, searching for weapons. Some thefts and maltreatment cases have been also reported, according to Al-Isawi.
The uncivilized and savage means of searching lead to an increase in the resistance activities, also making many Iraqis hate and detest these troops.
Many Iraqis say that the American administration should restore public services and security to the country as a first step in restraining people and making them content. Then Iraqis have to feel that they are respected by being allowed to establish their own independent government. This will greatly affect public opinion and build new bridges of trust between the two parties. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Al-Rawi from Baghdad.
The United States is facing an imminent natural gas crisis. Demand in winter 2002-2003 hit an all-time high, leaving natural gas stocks over 39% short of what they were last year at this time. The record drawdown of stored gas led to prices as high as $30 per thousand cubic feet. That's the equivalent of paying $16 for a gallon of milk, according to the American Chemistry Council. The peak storage refill period runs from May through mid-July. By late July, summer electricity demand usually limits the amount of natural gas available for storage. Will there be adequate natural gas supplies for the winter? Maybe not, as Kelly Ramirez reports from California. Experts are saying that North America is running out of gas.
The natural gas crisis in North America is part of the bigger issue of global depletion of fossil fuels. The world is now at the peak of production for petroleum, meaning that oil will be scarcer and more expensive in years to come. The production life cycle of oil fields can be charted along a bell curve. But natural gas fields deplete in a different pattern than oil wells, says Dale Allen Pfeiffer, contributing editor for Energy for the newsletter From the Wilderness.
There's a rise as production is laid in. That eventually leads to a plateau, which extends for some period of time. And then there is a precipitous cliff, which usually doesn't have much warning.
The United States currently uses 23 trillion cubic feet of gas per year. That's the equivalent of 4 billion barrels of oil. But the United States produces only 20 trillion cubic feet domestically, and demand is increasing as more cleaner-burning natural gas-fired power plants are being built. Some gas is imported from overseas, especially from Trinidad, in liquefied form called LNG. Russia and Central Asia have large amounts of gas, but LNG imports from the other side of the world are not practical. LNG is loaded onto specialized tankers that can only offload in specialized ports. The United States has only 3 such ports, with a 4th scheduled to open by year's end. Then the liquid must be converted to gas before the fuel enters the pipeline system. 15% to 20% of the energy is lost in transport. So the U.S. gas supply must come primarily from North America. But Mexico has fallen off the production cliff. It now imports gas from the United States, which in turn is importing more and more gas from Canada. Bill Powers, editor of the newsletter Canadian Energy Viewpoint, says Canada won't be able to keep up its export pace much longer.
For the first time in 16 years, Canada is going to experience a significant natural gas production decline in the range of 3% to 4%. Canada has increased its exports to the United States fivefold over the last 15 years, thus masking the real supply-demand imbalance in the U.S. However, this trend is coming to an end.
Fertilizers come from natural gas. Over the last 3 years, high prices for natural gas have shut down 20% of the fertilizer plants in the U.S. permanently. Another 30% are shut pending a drop in prices that may never come. Since fertilizers can be easily transported overseas, Julian Darley, co-founder of the Post Carbon Institute, suggested a possible source of foreign fertilizer.
The Middle East is gearing up to become the producer of 25% of the world's fertilizer because they have lots of so-called stranded natural gas, no market for it, and they're only too pleased to make fertilizer because then when they ship the fertilizer back, they not only ship fertilizer, they ship their water problem as well because they then buy relatively cheap U.S. grain, so the U.S. has to use its water, and there is a coming water crisis in North America as well. And, of course, Saudi Arabia, for instance, is very short of water.
That then makes the Middle East even more geostrategically important to the United States.
Absolutely.
In the face of a crisis that could make the cost of heating fuel too high for some Americans this winter, U.S. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham called a summit of energy producers on June 26th, which Julian Darley observed. Darley noted that neither petrogeologists nor alternative energy producers had been invited. The invited producers' solutions were rather predictable.
All the producers, the extractors, were saying, give us the permit so that we can go out and drill in the Rocky Mountains, drill in the Gulf of Mexico where we've been prevented, and drill on both the Atlantic and the Pacific margins where we've also been prevented. So it's a drilling mandate and, of course, a mandate to drill in Anwar in Alaska, and please give us more money to build the pipeline to Alaska. So those were basically the short-term solutions. They're really none of them going to work as short-term solutions. The only real method is fervent prayer, I think.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
As baseball's biggest stars converge on Chicago for Tuesday's All-Star Game, the sport is in a more stable position than it was last year when a looming player strike threatened to curtail the season. In the years since, ownership and players have at least temporarily patched up their differences over salaries, drug testing, and the elimination of 2 teams, the Minnesota Twins and the Montreal Expos. However, as Brendan Sweeney reports, Major League Baseball has continued to alienate many of the communities with which they interact, most recently in the bidding process for the proposed move of the Montreal Expos.
When Major League Baseball became embroiled in the conflict between players and owners last year, the fate of two teams became inextricably entangled in the fight. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig argued that the economic realities of the game necessitated the elimination of the Montreal Expos and Minnesota Twins. After a successful lawsuit and a binding labor agreement, Major League Baseball has since shifted to trying to relocate the Expos franchise, which it bought during its attempts at contraction.
The Major League Baseball actually bought the Expos with the threat that we're going to shut them down.
Neil DeMoss is an independent journalist and author of Field of Schemes, a critical text on corporate welfare and public funding of stadiums and arenas.
So they're thinking, okay, what can we do to try and maximize how much money we can get out of cities with the Expos? So they were trying to get this bidding war going amongst basically Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, and Portland, Oregon, to see who would come up with the best stadium deal.
Among the demands put forth by the league is that prospective venue cities build a new stadium facility, with all or significant funding coming from city governments. However, the D.C. government set a unique precedent last month when it suspended a bill to arrange funding for a stadium. Democratic Councilman Jack Evans made news when he tabled the issue and forced the mayor to negotiate tough with Major League Baseball. He explains that his actions were motivated not out of opposition to bringing the franchise to D.C. or to paying in part for a stadium, but in what he calls the arrogance with which the institution of baseball has behaved vis-a-vis its potential suitor cities.
I think a new stadium for a team in D.C. is essential. The issue is never if we support it. Everybody supports it. Everybody supports the stadium. Everybody supports getting the team. The question comes, who's going to pay for it? And that therein is the problem. Major League Baseball is, I think, making a tremendous mistake by antagonizing some of the cities where we're trying to get a team to locate. Part of the reason I did what I did is because I don't trust them and I don't believe them.
Headquartered in New York, Major League Baseball has always marketed itself as America's national pastime, emphasizing the sport's tradition and links to the cultural history of its host communities. However, baseball activists and scholars such as Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College and author of May the Best Team Win, argue that the existence of these linkages has not precluded opportunistic business practices.
There's no formal social contract. There might be an implicit one, but the economic reality is such that the leagues and the teams have all the leverage, and so when it's in their economic interest to break the social contract, they do.
Zimbalist has documented the economic costs and benefits of stadium construction and determined that public-funded stadiums, usually costing around $300 million, are usually drags on local economies and often force city governments to choose between lucrative financing to lure and keep teams and other essential infrastructure such as schools and fire services.
Roughly what the relationship between Major League Baseball and the host cities are is about what the U.S. occupying force in Iraq is to the Iraqi people.
Doug Pappas is the chairman for the Society for American Baseball Research. He argues that Commissioner Bud Selig and Major League Baseball's behavior as a business off the diamond has often contrasted starkly with the wholesome image it has attempted to cultivate, as they have tried to force communities into deals that shackle them with long-term debt and little short-term benefit.
You know, he speaks the social contract language and terms and concepts like that when it's an abstract issue, and then when push comes to shove and money gets involved, suddenly it's just like, you know, General Motors deciding, okay, are we going to build our new plant in Alabama or Georgia? Okay, government, you know, who'll build it for us and do whatever else we want?
Due in part to the actions of the D.C. city government, Major League Baseball, which was supposed to use Tuesday's All-Star Game as a venue for announcing the Expo's new home, have postponed the announcement. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Brendan Sweeney.
Zahira Sheikh and her mother were main witnesses to the Hindu-Muslim riots in Gujarat, India in March 2002. The two said recently they were intimidated by local authorities and left out testimony which would have led to the prosecution of those responsible for the violence. While critics charge that influential public figures have made a mockery of the justice system, others are more concerned with the justice denied to the survivors of the pogrom, where more than 1,000 Muslims were killed. Binu Alex follows the case from Gujarat, India.
Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, National Human Rights Commission of India, and millions of people's outrage has not changed the position of the right-wing Hindu BJP Gujarat government. After being allegedly party to the sectarian violence in Gujarat, which killed more than 1,000 Muslims last year, the Indian state continues to remain silent on the issue. but not the witnesses in the trial, who recently went public that they were harassed and intimidated by right-wing Hindu legislators into reversing their statements. The key witness, Zahira Sheikh, who reversed his statement, has now approached the National Human Rights Commission, calling for a new independent investigation.
If you want to live, reverse your statements and say you don't know all these guys. Nobody supported me. I did go to all the people, including the Muslim Relief Committee, but none helped me.
Teesta Setalwat, a member of Citizens for Peace and Justice, who ferried Zahira to Mumbai, has followed her case and says the Muslim witnesses in the trial got a raw deal.
We'll be shocked to see that Zahira Sheikh and the whole family was not even had one meeting with the state public prosecutor. In a criminal trial, it's the state public prosecutor who handles the case on behalf of the victim. They did not call them, they did not brief them, they did not ask any questions. This is the state of the criminal justice system in Gujarat.
As witnesses came forward accusing the Hindu government of harassing them to change their testimonies, new questions are being raised about the trial. While all the Muslims arrested were under what critics call the Draconian Prevention of Terrorist Act, or POTA, meant primarily for terrorists and where no bail is allowed, the Hindus were not subjected to the same type of treatment. The police records with the State Home Department indicate that in at least six other cases where witnesses deposed, the police are yet to arrest a single accused. The Muslim witnesses in these cases who gave deposition have lodged protests, saying that the Hindus out on bail are threatening them. Professor J.S. Bandukwala says it exposes the criminal justice system in India.
This particular case may cause more damage to Gujarat than even the riot, the violence of last year, because it breaks the very line that there can be a law and order, that the feeling that the law and order has broken down in Gujarat.
Legal experts in India predict none of the accused Hindus will be convicted in light of the recent acquittal of 21 Hindus and the lack of evidence presented during the trial. These legal luminaries say the police deliberately did not assist with the investigations. Human rights groups like Citizens for Peace and Justice are now contemplating for reopening the case by an independent central agency. Javed Anand is one of them.
We believe that, see, appeal is normally against the judgment on the basis of the available evidence. We feel the evidence itself has not been taken properly, and therefore it's not a question of appeal, we want a retrial of the case.
Even as some Indian media and human rights activists decry the recent ruling, very few in Gujarat seems to be paying attention, particularly the powerful Hindu trading community in Gujarat, who witnessed but have little or no remorse about the large-scale killings. Worse, the local BJP government has already concluded that the entire episode of 1,000 Muslims killed was due to a mob fury. However, survivor and witness Zahira has other thoughts on the matter.
Everyone is hand in glove with each other. It is their people, it is their government, and they want this case to fall. Lawyers, police, judge, they all are one. I don't want to go back.
From Gujarat, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley, California, and WBAI in New York City, with headlines produced at community station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Jackson Allers.